This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello there, and welcome to our weekly review of the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good afternoon.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Daniel DeSanto.
Good to be here.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
So the United States has been at war in Afghanistan for 18 years, the longest war in America's history. The Trump administration says it's on the cusp of an agreement that will end this war. For this, we'll turn to Brent.
These negotiations have been going on for, I believe, about a year and a half now. So sometime between the Taliban, of all people, and the United States government. The Taliban was who the United States came into Afghanistan to fight against because they were harboring the Al-Qaeda terrorist organization that Osama bin Laden belonged to. And so these have been going on for some time, and there have been some back and forth, some rumors that a deal was coming. Well, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, released a statement earlier this morning saying that negotiations with the Taliban were going well and that there was going to be a week of reduced force, let's say just basically laying down your weapons for about a week to see if that could happen, reduce tension. And then following that, towards the end of this month, there is going to be, it seems, a peace deal that would work out between the Taliban and the United States that would somehow see the United States forces left from that country. It's not exactly sure how many forces are going to be left or the timetable of how many are going to leave. But that is what the Taliban is after, the United States exit from Afghanistan. And then what the United States is meant to get in return is that the Afghani soil will not be used to house terrorist organizations or facilitate the transit of terrorist organizations or in any way support terrorist organizations such as Al-Qaeda and others. They're the basic terms, it seems, that are going to come out of this deal. And now we have a week long to see if there's any going to be much violence between the Taliban and the United States there. And if so, we might have a deal that's implemented, people are saying, February 29th.
18 years ago, it was terrorists on Afghani soil that perpetrated the 9/11 attacks, at least in part. There were obviously other actors involved, but the United States has been fighting all of this time in response to that significant provocation on American soil by Middle Eastern terrorists. 18 years, something like, what, 3,000 or 4,000 soldiers spent several trillion dollars in the war efforts there, and we end up where relative to where we started?
Right, we end up, well, the United States ends up giving the land over to the enemy that they were fighting against and just kind of walking away in the hopes with the promise that Afghanistan doesn't resort back to its terrorist harboring policies that it has had for so many years. And so, yeah, we can't really say there's any fruits from this. At this point, President Trump coming in, you know, I can understand his reasoning for being like, well, we've been there a long time and we couldn't defeat this ragtag bunch of people up in the hills, and we're the strongest military on earth. What's going on? And we've dedicated so much money and lives to it. Let's just leave with some amount of, with the best deal as we can possibly get. Mm-hmm. And he must hate the terms of this deal. I mean, he's got a weak negotiating position going in, knowing that he wants to leave and that the Taliban is on a resurgence. And no, the only way that they would be removed from power is from greater force. And so judging all that, he comes in and he's trying to negotiate the best he can get. I think what we could spend all day talking about that. But there was also something else that was linked to this release.
Well, before we get to that, I do think it's interesting just pointing out the fact that at the time that we went into Afghanistan, the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, was talking about the fact that because we were not going after the head of the snake, the terrorist snake, which was Iran, that this would prove to be a fruitless effort. And we've drawn attention to that prophecy in Leviticus 26 several times about God saying that because of your sins nationally, that you'll suffer the curse of your strength being spent in vain. You can't help but look at the way that this whole drama has played out and see how much strength the United States has spent in an effort to address the problem that came to our shores back on 9/11 in 2001, and see anything other than just a dramatic fulfillment of exactly what God said would happen.
Yeah, I think there is no possible, I don't know how you could have a greater fulfillment, a greater representation of that prophecy. That prophecy indicates there in Leviticus that, you know, the United States or modern day Israel, it has strength. It has an amazing amount of strength, and it has pride in its power as well, as it says. And it says that God is the one that breaks it. And so you have, as you said, you know, all this money, all this weaponry, the greatest military that the earth has ever seen coming up against, I don't want to, well, it's the Taliban. I mean, they're not even a state actor. And with all of the time and effort and money, cannot defeat them. That is a powerful testament to what God has done, really, in response to the sins of America and bringing this curse upon the nation, that they are unable to successfully navigate a war against anybody, even the Taliban.
So this other point that you wanted to bring out, this is regarding an article in the New York Times.
That's right. There's an op-ed in the New York Times today. And or it might have been even yesterday. And this is written by Surajuddin Haqqani. The Haqqani part should be really familiar to people that at least, oh, I've heard that name before, because the Haqqani network is a part of the Taliban's, made up part of the Taliban's, got about 5,000 fighters. They've been around for a long time fighting against U.S. forces inside Afghanistan since the very beginning. This Haqqani network, who is basically the father of this man, started this network, terrorist network that was in cahoots with the Taliban, that are in cahoots with the Taliban. They harbored Osama bin Laden in the caves up there in the mountains. So they had an extremely close working relationship with Osama bin Laden. And here you had now the son, which is Surajuddin. He is the deputy leader of the Taliban, but he is the leader of the Haqqani network. He is penning a op-ed in the New York Times. This is a man that's on the designated list of terrorists. This is the man with a $5 million bounty on his head, responsible for a lot of American lives. And he is allowed by the New York Times to then pen a piece of propaganda full of lies, stating that numerous things that, you know, the Taliban didn't ask for the United States to come into our nation. We did not provoke this. There's a number of quotes. I'll just give you a couple of them. This is one. It says this from Haqqani: "We did not choose our war with the foreign coalition led by the United States. We were forced to defend ourselves," which is an absolute lie, because they were the ones that brought in Osama bin Laden. They are the ones that facilitated the attack on September 11th, the Haqqani network. The man that this group, that he represents, the group that was behind that, or at least allowing the Taliban to be there. This is what Beckett Adams wrote today about this. She said, "No one forced the Taliban to invite al-Qaeda to establish its base of operations in Afghanistan, and then which caused the September 11th terrorist attacks. No one forced the Taliban to fight alongside al-Qaeda. This fight was of the Taliban's own choosing, and now, having suffered nearly decades, ideally for its choices, it's using American newspaper to rewrite history." So again, who was the intended target of the invasion in Iraq? It was al-Qaeda. It was al-Qaeda, and then the Taliban, as they would facilitate al-Qaeda. And so they chose, the Taliban did, with the Haqqani network backing them, to support Afghanistan, support al-Qaeda, and that's why they were attacked by the United States. This, if you read this, I mean, that's just one thing. One other part it says of this op-ed, it says, "We are aware of concerns of Afghanistan being used by disruptive groups. These concerns are inflated. Reports about foreign groups in Afghanistan are politically motivated exaggerations by warmongering players on all sides of the war." Translation, He's saying people are concerned that, you know, Afghanistan is going to be used by disruptive groups, aka terrorist organizations. These aren't true. They're inflated. When this very man and this very group has done exactly that for the past two decades, which led to the September 11th terrorist attacks. And yet this is what the New York Times audience is being fed. Blatant lies without any type of, let's say, like little context fact box or, underneath, a fact-checked box underneath by the New York Times to show the public how many lies he has written, this terrorist. It's like Qasem Soleimani going to the New York Times and writing an op-ed about saying how great Iran is and how he isn't behind all these terrorist attacks, or even Osama bin Laden himself. Would the New York Times go that far? I mean, we saw how the media gloated over the funeral procession of Qasem Soleimani, the number one terrorist on the planet responsible for thousands of American deaths. This man is very similar to that. And here he is featured in arguably the number one newspaper in the United States.
We've just sent our April 2020 edition of The Trumpet off to press yesterday. It'll appear on the website next week. But there's an article by Gerald Fleury called The Deadly Left-Wing Media. And he talks about just how much this plays into the hands of the enemies of the United States and how little regard for truth the media have. And he goes back into the history of Winston Churchill prior to World War II and the way that the left-wing media just rabidly fought against him trying to put the truth out to the public of what was happening in Germany. And you see the same kind of story playing out today, but this is probably one of the most egregious examples of that, just how little regard for truth and how much they're undermining the interests of the United States in publishing something like this. The New York Times, how far it has fallen. Well, we'll put links to a few articles in the show notes about this war in Afghanistan, and do look for that article by Gerald Fleury. It should be going up on the Trumpet site next week. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Over to Asia now. We have a story from Pakistan, but before we get to that, we'll get a quick update on the coronavirus. This is actually the cover story of this Trumpet edition that we've just sent off to press. Gerald Fleury has an article, Coronavirus in Prophecy. You can watch for that on the website. For the latest on this outbreak, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this week the death toll for the Wuhan coronavirus crossed 2,000. So it's blown far beyond the number that SARS killed back in the early 2000s. The number infected in Beijing has also begun to rise quickly. And also in South Korea, they now have 200 infected. And two actually have died there in South Korea now. So the virus is spreading further and further from the city of Wuhan, where it originated. But over the last couple of days, there was a small decrease in the overall reported infection rates and death rates in Wuhan. So even though it's getting worse in some areas away from that epicenter, it's kind of ground zero, the hope is that China has finally passed the peak of the illness and maybe making some gains in containing it. Beijing is now really trying to capitalize on this potential sort of cresting of infection numbers to try to convince the world to resume ties with China. Mm-hmm. But many nations are still, you know, very concerned, very troubled by it. So they're shutting down their borders with China. Even Russia, which we know is a very close partner to China, has blocked all Chinese nationals from entering the country. And so China's really struggling to mitigate this, and it could have some serious economic impacts, even if it were to be back to business as usual tomorrow.
Well, thank you for that. Now let's get to your actual number one Asia story from this week, the testing of a new nuclear-capable cruise missile by Pakistan.
Yes, the Pakistani military successfully test-fired a new version of their Rod-2 nuclear-capable air-launched cruise missile. This was on February 16th, and they launched it from one of the Pakistani Air Force's Mirage 3 fighter jets. And the military published a statement about the test launch, saying that this new version of the Rod 2 can travel up to 375 miles, which is almost twice the range of the earlier model of this missile. And then the statement noted that the missile also has state-of-the-art guidance and navigation systems, ensuring engagements of targets with high precision. And then it explained that it's really the combination of that longer range and the increased precision in navigation that significantly enhances the military's nuclear strike abilities. So this is it is a notable development for one of the world's very few nations that are known to have nuclear weapons. You know, Pakistan is one of the most recent countries to join that exclusive club. It was only in 1998 that they detonated their first nuclear weapon. And in the two decades since then, Pakistan has steadily developed warheads that are more powerful, more compact, more numerous, of course. They have possibly up to 100 weapons now. And also, as shown by this development this week, they've been developing more advanced systems for delivering those nuclear warheads.
One aspect of the story out of Pakistan over the years, as it's developed as a nuclear power, is the fact that of the nuclear powers in the world, it's probably the least politically stable, and it has the most potential for bad actors to get a hold of those weapons.
That's a huge and terrifying part of this story, because at the exact same time as Pakistan has been making all these developments in its nuclear arsenals, parts of the country have been becoming just hotbeds, really, for radical Islam. And it creates some really worrying questions about the security of these unfathomably destructive weapons. Michael Morell is a former acting director of the CIA, and he recently said, quote, "Pakistan is the most dangerous country in the world. Anti-state jihadist extremism is growing in the country, creating a nightmare society down the road, an extremist government in Islamabad with nuclear weapons," end quote. So that's just such an alarming possibility, and Morell isn't the only one to call attention to this. The Brookings Institute recently wrote about how Pakistan has been providing direct military intelligence and aid to what Brent was just talking about a moment ago, the Haqqani Network, which is just an especially savage branch of the Taliban. Brookings said that Pakistan's aid to the Haqqani Network has resulted in the deaths of U.S. soldiers, Afghan security personnel, and civilians, plus significant destabilization of Afghanistan. But none of that has stopped Pakistan's military, even at the senior levels, from continuing to fund and support these terrorists. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has also written about the insecurity of Pakistan's nuclear weapons, especially stressing how they could fall into the hands of jihadists who are aligned with Iran. So he wrote that Pakistan could soon become a, quote, proxy of the Iranian mullahs, and that would mean that all those nuclear weapons are under Iran's control. So Pakistan has a really serious nuclear arsenal, and the new missile test this week shows that it's becoming more and more advanced and dangerous, and it looks like it could be just a matter of time before those weapons fall into jihadists' hands.
What would be the best resources that you'd point people to learn more about this?
I would recommend, for anyone who wants to know more about the biblically prophetic significance of this, to read Mr. Fleury's booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. It just shows how World War III is prophesied to be nuclear, and the scriptures really make that clear. It's a powerful booklet.
Well, Jeremiah has an article that he has written. It should be going up on the website soon. Pakistan's nuclear weapons get a longer range and greater precision. You can watch for that there on the website, as well as Mr. Fleury's booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. We'll put links to those both in our show notes for today's program. Thanks, Jeremiah. A deadly shooting in Germany has raised concerns about anti-immigrant and far-right violence. For this story, we'll go to Daniel DeSanto.
Right. On February 19, just a couple of days ago, a far-right gunman in the German city of Hanau killed 9 people, mostly all foreigners, all immigrants. Then afterwards, he went and, as usual with the shooter, killed himself and a member of his family. But this was a 43-year-old German man, seems pretty ordinary from everything we knew about him on the surface.
at least, but he published this 24-page manifesto not long before, in which he set out Nazi views, really far-right extreme views, talking about the extermination of entire races and peoples in Africa and the Middle East. Now, these far-right attacks are becoming more and more frequent. We keep seeing more of these people setting out their manifestos, which have concerning elements of Nazism and extreme far-right sentiment in them, and increasingly people going to violence. So he killed about 10 people in that attack. And he was an educated man. He had a university degree. His manifesto was written in excellent German. And this breaks the stereotype that most people think of. When they think of the far right in Germany, they probably think of the torch holding, you know, protesting kind of crazy person who's not really educated that much at all. But this is somebody who had a university degree. He could have been any ordinary German, but he committed this atrocity, attacking migrants, killing 10 of them. So there are many examples of this far-right surging in Germany. All you have to do is look a few weeks back where you saw the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, and it helped form a government in the state of Thuringia for the first time since World War II. This is breaking precedent. Another example, the German army and police, the ones who are supposed to be fighting these attackers, these assailants who go on killing sprees, they are actually being investigated by the government for far-right sympathies, or even for being, in some cases, disposed to far-right violence. There are about 12,000 in just one of these government research or investigations which are going on. About 12,000 people who are suspected of actually being disposed to violence or at risk of committing far-right violence. And this is actually the third far-right attack since June. So this is not just some isolated incident that happens once every 3 years. Since June 2019, there have been three of these high-profile attacks. And most of them are centered on the issue of migrants. You had the shooting of the politician, Walter Lübcke, who was gunned down right in front of his home, actually. And he was killed mainly because the assailant was angry at Chancellor Merkel's migration policy. He had recently come out and supported the migration policy, the policy which has brought millions of migrants into Europe from primarily the Middle East and, well, primarily Africa, and some from the Middle East as well. So this is just one of many of these examples. Now, you often will see these videos of the protesters marching. They'll have their torchlight rallies just like they had in Nazi times, trying to mimic that. But it's important to remember that this is not perhaps as isolated as people would like to think or would hope. Because for every one of these people who commits a violent act, or for every person who marches in one of those torchlight rallies, there's going to be probably about 100 others who have similar tendencies, who have similar leanings towards the far right, but who don't express themselves so much in violent actions. Mm-hmm. They might express themselves online. There's plenty of those. They might express themselves in a political vote, like voting for the AfD. We know that this support for the AfD is growing. So for every one of these people who commits such an atrocity, there are unfortunately more, and many of them are even in the police or the military.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to make, the fact that when you see an incident like this, you know Chancellor Merkel and so many German politicians, they jump on this and just are very firm in resisting and condemning this kind of act and trying to distance themselves from this. But as you said, it's kind of the extremist point of the spear of something that is a broader concern within the country. Not only do you have the rise of a party like the AfD, which, again, there would be a lot of Germans who they're not necessarily explicitly racist, but they are concerned about immigration in the country, who would be attracted to a party like that. But you also do have the rise of anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic attacks within the country that is a broader trend. You don't necessarily have a lot of murderers But you would have desecration of Jewish grave sites and that type of thing. So there is this kind of sickness that you see developing within Germany and expressing itself in a multitude of different ways. We have another story in our April 2020 Trumpet print edition that just went to press from Richard Palmer. The title of it is Echoes of the 1930s. He's tracking what happened in Germany leading up to World War II. Politically, what was it that enabled the Nazi Party to come to power the way that it did? And you see some really startling similarities in what's happening politically in Germany today. And it is kind of riding this groundswell of discontent among the populace, a much broader trend than what, say, a single incident like this would tend to indicate.
At the Munich Security Conference just a few days ago, Frank-Walter Steinmeier said this about the anti-Semitic and far-right forces which are rising in Germany. Quote, "I wish I could say that the lessons we Germans have learned from history would last forever. But I cannot when hatred and hate speech is spreading. Today, the evil spirits of the past are emerging in our country in a new guise." So that's what this man said in front of many world leaders at that conference. And in some ways, yes, in some ways it's your new guys, but in some ways it's also very, very obvious even and reminiscent of the past, reminiscent of the 30s when the far right was rising. Nazism did not totally disappear, as we know, after the Second World War. It actually went underground. You can read Mr. Richard Palmer's article, "The Nazi Underground Revealed," on thetrumpet.com for a great historical and prophetic overview of where Nazism went after World War II and why you should be concerned about its rise again today.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Daniel. Another story in our April 2020 Trumpet print edition is called American Bolsheviks. It's about the supporters of Democrat presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, who have some quite radical ideas, and some of whom are even talking about using violence to implement them. Well, things could get very interesting because as the Democratic Party continues the process of selecting its candidate for the presidency, Senator Sanders has emerged as the clear frontrunner. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, American politics definitely are heating up. We've got the big Nevada primary tomorrow. But the polls show that it looks like Senator Sanders is set to win that primary and many other primaries going forward. All the polls show him as the front runner. If you look at like betting websites, they're giving him like up to 60% odds of being the Democratic nominee. Some very powerful officials within the Democratic National Convention concerned that a socialist can't actually win a general election against Donald Trump are getting very creative in trying to find ways to stop him from being the nominee.
Yeah, they're concerned that he might not be able to beat Donald Trump. A lot of people would be concerned that he might actually beat Donald Trump. I mean, it's hard to see that happening, but the level of support for his policies is really quite something.
Right. No, that actually is a good observation, just showing how radical the so-called moderate Democrats are, is they're not out there talking about like, oh no, a communist is going to take over America. They're more like, oh no, we might nominate a communist and he probably won't be popular amongst independents, so we might not get the presidency.
Right.
They
would prefer Bernie Sanders and a socialist administration to the one that's in place right now.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. They would prefer Bernie Sanders to his socialist administration to the Trump administration. They just don't think he can win. Mm-hmm. And so that's what you're looking at now, is there was hope that former Vice President Joe Biden would be able to get the nominee, but they kind of shot themselves in the foot with the impeachment investigations there. It revealed more corruption about Joe Biden than it did about Donald Trump, and so his campaign's pretty much tanked. And so now you're looking at the New York billionaire Mike Bloomberg's jumped in last minute, and there's talk that they're like, well, maybe we can get Hillary Clinton to come back as Bloomberg's vice president, and then together they can get enough votes not to beat Sanders, but at least tie with him. And then if we go to a brokered convention, first brokered convention since 1952, the super delegates, these elite lords of the Democratic Party, they get some votes in addition to the popular votes, could come in and give the nomination to them instead. But you do run the risk there. It is so ironic, almost be funny if it wasn't so tragic, is this party that's just gone back and forth how the Constitution's so racist for their Electoral College that let Donald Trump win despite the not getting the popular vote, uses a very similar system in its primary. So now they're talking about, like, well, we can't stop Bernie Sanders from being the most popular candidate, but there's still ways we can stop him from being the nominee. And so if they go to a brokered convention and they take the nominee, this nominee from Senator Sanders, his supporters will be able to quite honestly claim that he was cheated out of that nomination.
Right. There was already claims that that's exactly what happened in the last election.
Right. And so you're looking at, okay, well, where do you go from there? There's already been some calls from the far left is that why is Bernie Sanders even in the Democratic Party if they're going to treat him this way? He's got enough supporters. Why don't you just go start a third party, call it the People's Party or something like that? That was a socialist political party we had 100 years ago, and take half the Democratic Party with them. Even the congressional representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was making comments about how, well, in any other country in the world, I wouldn't have to be in the same political party as Joe Biden. We could have our own far left political party. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that is actually kind of a realistic thing that could happen if Sanders is cheated out of this nomination. Don't know what that's going to happen, but it's definitely when you start getting this division. That's what the point I made in the American Bolsheviks article you'd mentioned at the beginning of the segment that's coming out in the next Trumpet about the Social Democratic Party in Russia and this division between the more moderate Mensheviks and the more radical Bolsheviks, and then how they split, and then they went into election, which they both lost, and then declaimed it was rigged, and started a civil war that lasted 5 years, took 10 million lives, and ended with the creation of the Soviet Union. If you read that article, you'll see more and more. It's almost hard to keep up with them. I think there's four at least count Bernie Sanders paid employees keep getting up there and making comments like, well, the gulags weren't so bad. We need prison camps here to send Mitch McConnell and some of these other Republicans. The Bolshevik Revolution, they're like, we hope we don't have to do anything that extreme, but it's possible that might be what it takes to establish communism in the United States. So Sanders definitely has a supporting of movement who are not opposed to launching a violent civil war if they think the system's rigged against them.
And it's interesting, it seems like the other Democratic presidential candidates are going after Sanders to some degree on this point, that he's not reining in these individuals who are expressing these radical, even violent views, and he doesn't seem to be particularly interested in distancing himself from them.
No, and he's definitely he's probably not as radical as some of the people in his campaign, but Senator Sanders is definitely more radical than you've been led to believe. I mean, if you look at some of the older comments back in 1972, he wasn't even offended by being called a communist at the debate this week. Mike Bloomberg accused him of being a communist, and he called it a cheap shot and said that's not true. But it's like, back, you can find audio clips of him or interviews of him where he's saying that title didn't bother him at all. And so, no, he's not reining this movement in. Actually, even one of the people Project Veritas interviewed, they asked him, like, oh, well, does Bernie know about how radical your views are? And he's like, oh, yeah, he said Bernie's all about unity. He wants to build a broad coalition of far leftist, not that broad, but he's like said he's fine with democratic socialist and communist and both being in his campaign. He's not going to kick us out just because we want to send Mitch McConnell to a gulag.
Well, this story isn't going to go away. I mean, it'll be very interesting what happens in the lead up to the Democratic National Convention as these primaries continue to unfold. We'll learn more this weekend, and what happens when the party, the radical trend within that party either gets control, or you have people who decide that they're not going to allow it to get control. What sort of response do you get from those who are feeling pretty good about their chances right now? We looking at those prophecies, and you talk about them in that article about American Bolsheviks, about the kind of violence that the American populace is going to inflict on itself. You can definitely see events leading in that direction. We will keep our eye on it, and we thank you very much for that, Andrew. Watch for that article. It'll be coming up on the website next week. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, a serious blow to America's alliance with perhaps its closest ally in Asia, warming relations between Israel and surrounding Arab states, America's growing border crisis, and two divorces in Britain's royal family announced just this week. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The president of the Philippines is no fan of the United States, and this does not bode well for the long-standing close alliance between these two countries. This week, he made a move that struck a serious blow at this alliance. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, we spoke about this a little bit last month when it was mostly just whispers. It was just Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the United States. But now this is beyond bluster, and it has moved to concrete action. So this started with Duterte's drug war in the Philippines, which has gotten some impressive results, and it's been quite popular with many of the country's people. But the authorities under Duterte have relied on some illegal methods and some unconstitutional strategies as they've killed about 20,000 people in this war. So the U.S. was concerned about the unconstitutional side of the drug war, and they ended up triggering the Magnitsky Act over those extrajudicial killings and over the human rights abuses. And as part of that, they ended up denying a U.S. visa to one of President Duterte's close associates, and they froze his assets. So Duterte was, he was furious about that, and he has now terminated the Philippines' visiting forces agreement with the United States. This agreement is a key part of what lets the U.S. Navy sail freely through the Philippines' territorial waters, and it lets America keep military bases on Philippine territory. It also allows the U.S. to take part in joint military exercises with the Philippine military. So it's a wide-ranging bilateral deal, and it's something that's really been a key part of the U.S.-Philippines alliance for more than two decades. And now it's basically history. On February 11th, Duterte officially filed to terminate it. And that signals just, a serious break in the U.S.-Philippines military alliance.
I've heard people say that without that deal, there really isn't much to that alliance. It's that central to the actual, what does that alliance mean?
Right. Yes, there are other treaties and other pacts and agreements between the U.S. and the Philippines. But without the visiting forces agreement, the others are kind of gutted in a pretty significant way. So it'll be really interesting to see how the rest of the partnership and alliance there holds up with this part removed.
Why is this significant prophetically?
Well, the scriptures talk about a massive Asian army that'll be formed in the end time. And the book of Revelation says that it'll have just an incomprehensibly vast number of soldiers. And Bible prophecy shows that it will be a block of multiple Asian nations, not just one, you know, not just one country. And we know from the book of Ezekiel that Russia will be the head nation in this bloc, and that China will be in a position of junior leadership. But it will have 200 million soldiers total. So when we see the Philippines not just moving away from its traditional alliance with the United States, but also moving much closer to China, that's really behind a lot of Duterte's moves here. He's not just creating space between the Philippines and America, but he's also warming up to China quite a lot. And as we see that happening, it's really laying the foundation for those prophecies about this multinational Asiatic force to be fulfilled. And I think we can expect for some of the Philippines' 105 million people to contribute to that 200 million man army.
Well, thanks for that. We do have an article up on the website, actually by Daniel DeSanta, who's with us today, Philippines to End Military Cooperation Pact with the United States. Find that on thetrumpet.com. We'll link to it in the show notes for today's program. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. For generations, relations between Arabs and Jews in the Middle East have been terribly fraught, even violent. That makes the recent trend of cooperation between the Jewish state and some of its Arab neighbors especially interesting. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So we have heard a lot of reports that Israel's relations, as you said, are really warming with the Arab world, particularly recently with Sudan. This past week actually had the first flyover of a plane flying from Tel Aviv airport across to West Africa that could fly in Sudanese airspace, a result of the meeting that they had a couple of weeks ago, the couple of leaders from here in Sudan. That's one example. There are other stories about how soon Israel is going to have a non-aggression pact with some of the Gulf states, most notably Saudi Arabia. And this obviously would kind of be a crowning achievement for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as he has reached out to the Arab world to try and really capitalize on a lot of the things they have in common right now to try and get some type of agreements together. And in light of that, there was this article that was written by Harold Rode. He is a PhD in Islamic history. He served for 28 years as the Islamic Cultural Affairs Advisor to the Department of Defense in the United States. And he wrote an article, The History of Non-Aggression Pacts in Islam. And the piece, as I read through it this week, I thought would just be really beneficial for our readers to just be aware of a couple of these points he brings out. And they are, one, that a lot of the time these peace agreements or non-aggressive pacts that we have between the Arab world and Israel, there are a couple still current right now, they are really dependent upon the leadership of the country rather than the institutions of the countries themselves. And so if you have a peace agreement between, let's say, the United States and a different country, then that, because the leadership rotates so often, that generally does outlast the next administration that comes in. And he goes back in history to show that, you know, these are only as strong as the leader that signed them being in power. So that was point one. And the second point he brought out was very interesting, because I think it plays into Bible prophecy a lot, especially concerning these Arab nations and their relationship with Israel. And he said that these agreements that will be signed, they are going to be what a non-aggression or a truce agreement. And that agreement is basically as good as it is seemed valuable to have that agreement with the non-Muslim state. He gives an example back to the time of Muhammad, who had a truce, basically with another tribe, and that was because he couldn't defeat them. And this truce was meant to last for 10 years and only lasted for two, because mm-hmm. Muhammad figured that his power was sufficient enough to defeat them then, at which point he did. He turned on them. And so he brings up this history, the author does, and says that right now there is a motivation of Arab states to ally with Israel because of their shared enemy in Iran. And Iran, as we know, is pushing across the Middle East, pushing at Israel, but pushing at Saudi Arabia just as much. Saudi Arabia has been the target of their attacks of late. And so he says that there is this push for an agreement between Saudi Arabia and Israel because of that. Then he says this: any agreement they sign must with the Israelis must be understood on these terms. These are not peace agreements. They remain in force only as long as the leaders of these Arab countries believe it is in their interest. Mm-hmm. What would happen, for example, if the Iranian regime collapsed and the new government in Iran no longer threatened the Sunni Arab regimes? Would Israel and these Arab countries still share common interests? Would these agreements still hold? And he goes into some history to show that they probably wouldn't. Which is just really interesting in terms of biblical prophecy, because these Arab states that Israel is now normalizing ties, let's call it that, with the, let's say, Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states, Jordan, these are states that are that the Bible actually says belongs to a confederacy of nations, an alliance that is actually going to lead to Israel's destruction. And that destruction would happen after the Iranian Empire is, or the Iranian Kingdom is, has been destroyed. The prophecy that backs this up is found in Psalm chapter 83, and it talks about this confederacy that comes together with a German-led Europe. This German-led Europe prophecy talks about is the nation, is the group of nations that is going to destroy the King of the South, which is Iran. And in the aftermath of that, what happens in Psalm 83, this alliance that comes together of moderate Arab states and Germany, they take, as the Bible says, crafty counsel against Israel. This is an attack or let's say behind the scenes, they might have a relationship with Israel, but they are going to break that relationship and end up leading to Israel's destruction. And so I just thought that was really good, because that's what Bible prophecy says. But here we have a PhD in history that is explaining that these type of truces that Israel is working with the Arab states right now will only last as long as the Iranian threat is there. Once that is removed, then watch out. There's no guaranteeing any type of security from these deals.
Fascinating perspective. And yeah, you can't help but look at the normalization of relations between Israel and these Arab states without having a certain amount of skepticism, given what it says there in Psalm 83, that there's this underlying hatred for Israel. And you could almost be suckered into believing that, well, that's not really the case when you see what these people are doing. But yeah, to put that in its historical context really does give you a better idea of how that may play out. If you want more information about that, you can read our trend, an alliance between Arab nations and Europe. That's under the trends tab. Go check that out, and you can read more about that Psalm 83 prophecy. Thank you very much for that, Brent. U.S. President Donald Trump has made securing America's southern border a major priority. There's evidence he's making progress, but is it enough? For this, we'll go back to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the border crisis definitely still continues. They finally have some statistics out this week that last year the federal authorities apprehended over 850,000 illegal immigrants on the southern border. And that's a big number, and it sounds like a lot, but for context, that's half over again as many, 147% of the number that were apprehended the year before. Now, I guess maybe you could make the case that the Trump administration did a better job at catching illegals mm-hmm. this year than they did the year before, although there haven't been many big policy changes between 2018 and 2019, so it's more likely that there was just a lot more immigrants coming across the border to catch. Not really any way to count how many got across uncaught, mm-hmm. but 850,000 apprehended, and the government was only able to deport 267,000, so about 30% of those caught were deported. The rest, they're still in a backlog. And since we only have the facilities to keep about 50,000 immigrants in detention, that means about 500,000 of them were just given piece of paper saying appear in court on this day and then let out into American society. Mm-hmm. Those 500,000, they joined the rest. I think they estimate that there's actually about 3 million illegals in America with that court order. Maybe they'll show up. Maybe they already haven't. Maybe they don't plan on it. But it definitely keeps swelling the number of illegal immigrants in America. We know there's at least 11 million illegal immigrants living in America. By some estimates, it could be as high as 30 million. The discrepancy being mainly because, like I said before, it's hard to count the ones who weren't apprehended.
Mm-hmm.
But this is very prophetic. Actually, we can put a Key of David in the show notes from our editor-in-chief entitled The U.S. Southern Border Crisis Was Prophesied. And that Key of David will go through one of the main verses we always focus on for this, Deuteronomy 28 and verse 52. That chapter lists the curses that come on a nation that disobeys God. And then this one says that he shall besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down. Wherein you trust. And no, there's not actually a literal wall along most of the southern border with Mexico, to the chagrin of many conservatives. But this prophecy does still stand, is that you have this border that's not secured. You have illegals coming over, some of them bringing diseases, some of them bringing drugs, and introducing these other problems into U.S. society. And ironically, I mean, now there's a debate whether between the Republicans and the Democrats whether we should even be enforcing the border, with the Democrats calling to, like, abolish border security. Mm-hmm. Now, you read Deuteronomy 28, and God lists open borders in the curses section of the chapter, so the Bible definitely indicates it's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bad thing that's going to continue because of the sins of the people.
Mm. Well, thank you for that, and pointing to that Key of David program, U.S. Southern Border Crisis Was Prophesied, very good idea. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. Thank you, Andrew. The royal family of Britain has been suffering blow after blow lately, and this week two announcements that have many people talking about how this age-old institution seems to be disintegrating. For this, we go back to Daniel DeSanto.
That's right. There have been two, not one, but two divorces within just the week. This has left people who watched the royal family wondering what's coming next. First, there is the Queen's grandson, Peter Phillips, and he was taken completely by surprise on February 10th when his wife of 12 years, Autumn, told him that she wanted to separate. Now, just about 7 days later, the Queen's nephew, the Earl of Snowdon, put out a statement that they, both of them, were divorcing. They said they were amicably agreed to divorce. So it made it sound quite fine, like everything's just being taken care of, that everything's under control. But for the Queen, that's not so. The Queen has been suffering from all of the family turmoil of late. There was just the departure of Meghan and Harry not too long ago. That was bad enough for her, and then she has to see two people getting divorced, one of whom, the wife of Peter Phillips, Autumn, is actually one of her favorites, one of her favorite people in the royal family who she'll reserve a special spot for, even in her car on the way to church. And that's traditionally with the Queen been a very special spot. It's not just anybody who will get that kind of preferential treatment and be allowed to be around her in such a way like that. Now, both of these events have really shaken the royal family. People have wondered, well, did Meghan stepping down from her duties inspire others to go and break the status quo, to go and just ignore the precedents and do some very unprecedented things like divorce? Divorce hasn't been that common in the royal family up till recently. There was Charles and Diana all the way back in the 90s. But for a long time, it hasn't gotten this bad. The Sun wrote that it feels like the royal family is, quote, falling apart a little bit. And then, of course, later on, different news sources were saying that the royal family seems to be disintegrating after the second announcement came out. So what lies ahead? Well, we don't quite know. There could be even more. People were speculating that perhaps these newly divorced couples would also go over to Canada, since, and of course, in Autumn's case, she was a Canadian citizen. They were thinking, do they want to maybe go with Megan and Harry and get together? If so, it would still be, it would still possibly even damage the credibility of the remaining royals, of the Queen even, if they start to air certain things that they say that they know that they could go public with in an interview. Now, this is just speculation. There's a lot of speculation, as usual, with the royals. But the point remains, this is shaking the Queen terribly. She's already seen her husband have to renounce some of his duties because of ill health. And now she is in, I believe, her 94th year. And this is taking a severe toll on her ability to even keep the nation unified.
Well, it is stunning to see this developing. And yet, for anyone who's been following the trumpet, it's also not surprising, considering what our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, has been saying about the royal family. It was back a couple of years ago that he put that article in, The Fall of the British Royal Family. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program. But he talked about the reason why the royal family is falling apart so quickly. We also have an article in the last issue by Richard Palmer, Royal Family Divides Britain. That was in the wake of the Harry and Meghan Markle leaving the royal family. But it all points to this change that has happened with the throne of David, on which these royals sat until very recently. And that points to that book that Gerald Flurry has written about the new throne of David. So all of this is, there's a whole lot more going on here than what is evident in the headlines. But watching the royal family disintegrate as it is really is quite something to witness, given what we know to be true prophetically. Thank you very much for that, Daniel. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Daniel DeSanto, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Edith Sitwell. I am patient with stupidity, but not with those who are proud of it. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.